Ever wonder what a functioning campus and community radio station looks like? Ever stay up late at night asking yourself just how CITR stores all the CDs and records they have at their disposal? Ever wake up early with the burning question, how does CITR manage to be the best radio station in Vancouver? Well, you're in luck, because CITR 101.9 FM is having an open house this Friday, March 4th, between 12 and 4 p.m., and you're invited. Come on down to room 233 in the sub on UBC campus for snacks, station tours, and maybe even a chance to get on air. CITR is your radio station, and we want to show you what we're all about. So come to the open house, March 4th from 12 to 4 p.m.
Sexy and Van City Radio may contain adult content. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM, CITR.
Well, well, well. Welcome to Sexy and Van City Radio on 101.9 FM on CITR. Or maybe you could be one of our podcast listeners, however you've decided to spend the hour with us. We are very, very glad to have you. Tonight, we are going to have a very special guest on the show, which I'm very excited about. And it's a topic that's been pretty hot. You may have read about it in the Georgia Strait. You may have already bought the book because you're ahead of the curve. And it's one of those subjects that are really, really important to talk about. And especially in this day and age where there's designer vaginas and people are really, really not too happy about how they look. And apparently 89% of women think their genitalia is ugly. And that really broke my heart when I heard that stat. And I'm really excited to have Rena Robertson on. And she's going to be here chatting about her book. I'll show you mine. And it's this wonderful collection of over 60 women where you can see their vulvas and hear their stories as well on there. So welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. So tell me a little bit about this project, because as I was mentioning in the intro, I was just blown away about the fact that 89% of women just are not happy. They think that they're ugly.
Yeah, I just want to make that a little bit clear. Instead of 89% of women feeling that their vulvas or their genitalia are ugly, it's more accurate to suggest that they do not report their genitalia as being attractive, beautiful, or sexy. So they don't necessarily feel that their genitalia is ugly, but they don't have positive associations with it. They may feel neutral towards it, but I still think it's striking that 89% of women don't have a positive association with their genitalia. And this is something that I've really began to notice within the past year. Certainly it's been a problem for much of human history, women being very dissatisfied with their bodies. But in the past year, working in a strip bar, I've begun to notice that a number of women have been so uncomfortable with the appearance of their genitals that they've considered labiaplasty, which is the surgical reduction of the labia minora, and most often for cosmetic reasons.
I think it's heartbreaking, I really do. And I applaud you. So tell me about your project. And as you mentioned, just more and more women are looking at getting labiaplasty. And in terms of that, how that prompted you to start this process?
Well, where it really started was last summer. A few different women just independently came to me in the change room and explained to me that they were very uncomfortable with the way their vulvas looked. They said that they were really considering labiaplasty, and in, you know, absolute confidence and privacy, they said, "Hey, will you have a look at my vulva? I want you to offer your opinion. Tell me if you think that I'm normal." And a few things really struck me about that. First, it was heartbreaking to see these incredibly beautiful women be so uncomfortable about this part of their body that they were actually considering undergoing surgery to have it altered to fit into some artificially created ideal. And what else really struck me was that these women who work in the strip club, you know, we're all very comfortable being naked around each other. Women, when they're considering breast augmentation, are very open in discussing this. Everyone wants to feel each other's and, you know what kind of implants they got. But in discussing the topic of labiaplasty, these women made sure that no one else was around. They asked me in a very shy manner, and they were almost ashamed to say, hey, will you look at my vulva? And it really struck me that if these women that are probably among the most sexually liberal women in society, if they're uncomfortable talking about their genitals, if they're uncomfortable looking at another woman's or having another woman view theirs, I imagine that most women in society feel that very same way. So I was wondering, if women aren't getting to look at each other's vulvas, where are they getting this idea of what theirs should look like?
Mm-hmm.
So I really began to look into that, and what I discovered was that, unfortunately, the tool which has become sort of the reference for women is pornography. And of course, pornography, mainstream pornography, does not represent the full diversity of female anatomy.
No, it definitely does not. As I believe it was Sherry Winston I had on the show, she's the sex educator. She actually said pornography should be for entertainment, not for education, mm-hmm. which I thought was very apt.
Yeah, I think that people don't really understand the impact it has on them, though.
No.
Because a lot of studies have asked young people and older people, do you consider pornography as an educational tool? And many young people report that no, it's not their primary source of education or even a secondary or tertiary source of education. But I don't think that there's a realization of how deep the messages that are sent to us, you know, really impact us. So we might not go into it looking for it in terms of education, but when we see these same images, you know, reproduced time and time again, we see the pages of Playboy magazine not showing any inner labia, even though we might not be looking at that thinking that this is education on anatomy. It actually is. It really hits us deeply, and it becomes our baseline of normal.
Mm-hmm. I was surprised when you if you could just let our listeners know, earlier today when we had our conversation on the phone, our pre-interview, you'd mentioned to me just that I can't remember the exact, but in regards to Playboy, mm-hmm. where they're looking, going through all the pictures, where it was almost the same with where they chose into whether or not it was airbrushing or how they went about it. That,
well, I think there are two really interesting components of this study that was just out last year. In the first part, they looked at Playboy centerfolds from 1953 up until the year 2008. And, you know, they really recognize these trends, especially in the past decade. There's this very strong trend towards the hairless norm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, vulvas nowadays are very rarely represented with any hair. And I don't know if that is reflecting the societal norm or if it's causing the societal norm. But it's definitely part of our society today that it's removing the pubic hair is very, very common. And then the more alarming statistic is they looked at every single photograph over 1 year between 2007 and 2008. It was a total of 185 photographs, and only in 7% of these photos were there any sign of labia minora, the inner labia, whatsoever. And only in a single photo out of 185 was the inner labia a color other than light red or pink. So women not being aware that digital alterations, airbrushing of photos goes all the way down to the level of a female's genitals, without that knowledge, there's so many women looking through this magazine and thinking, wow, I'm completely abnormal.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes for men as well. Men will look through this magazine and begin to believe that what is represented is normal. So it might seem abnormal when they see a woman with visible inner labia.
And even through the book, there's, like, you've got over 60 women through the book who are photographed, and each one is so different, where, like, it's kind of amazing where I was just shocked, like, just how many different types. And I have to say, I give men and lesbians kudos because I wouldn't have a clue what to do. So.
Yeah, it's really been amazing. Every person that I've had the pleasure of giving the book to in person, every single woman that has seen it, you know, from strippers to mothers, every single person that has flipped through those pages is just amazed at the diversity. You know, we really don't have an understanding how many vulvas have most women seen. You know, not many. We don't really have an understanding of the diversity in terms of, you know, color and size and shape. It's really beautiful.
It is, and it makes it challenging, even though, like, for general health as a health practitioner, just even having the knowledge that, especially if you've grown up where you think that, and the first point of contact and visualization was through pornography, and then going in and actually seeing the real deal.
Right.
It's going to be a bit of a shock.
Yeah. So, and it's also interesting you brought up the medical profession. You know, also there was a study looking at medical drawings, anatomical textbooks, and also not found to represent the full diversity of reality. And, you know, there are kind of logistical reasons for that. In drawing the anatomy, the structures have to be a certain size, so other structures aren't obscured, but other structures are obvious enough, you know, so the inner labia tend to be just big enough to be seen and labeled, but not too big that they cover, say, the clitoris or the entrance to the vagina. But if these are the images that doctors and medical professionals are being educated with, then they too may not have a real idea of what normal is. So when young women or older women go to the doctor and say, you know, look at, I'm not normal. I have studies that have found that not all doctors say, you know what, you're well within the range of normal. So it's very important for medical professionals as well to be really aware of the diversity that exists.
Definitely. And the other thing that you brought up earlier in our pre-chat as well was in regards to the nurses, and it's like it down there,
right.
And it's interesting because I was hoping, because with Eve Ensler's work she's done with the vagina monologues, which I love because yours is so authentic, and I love the fact that right now people can actually write their stories and send them in to you on the website, which I think is beautiful. That's coming up soon. So
I'll go back to, you know, the way that medical professionals even sometimes have a difficult time expressing these words out loud. One of the stories that's shared in the book, which is really compelling, is one of the women had an experience where she went to the doctor and she had to get some tests done, and the nurse said to her that she needed a swab under her armpit and also down there, and vaguely motioned. And this woman was like, well, where are you talking about? You know, I've got there's lots of my body down here. And the nurse would not say vagina, would not say vulva. So finally they came to some understanding of what was expected. But this woman said, you know, if she had been any more shy, this conversation could have lasted for who knows how long. And since then, she's had the very same experience with people who have delivered babies or other medical professionals still have a very hard time saying the word vagina. And I mean, that in itself sends a very strong message to women. If your doctor or your nurse can't even say the word vagina, you know, people that we have respect for in this way, send a message to us that, yes, these words are shameful. Speaking about our genitals is shameful.
Why do you think that is in terms of society?
Wow, I mean, I think it goes back, you know,
to Victorian era?
So long. Yeah, even before that. You know, human sexuality has always been a taboo subject, especially women's sexuality. And, you know, it's just been part of our society for a very long time. I mean, if we look back, for example, to language, looking back at the Latin term for the external genitalia, that word is pudendum. It originally referred to both male and female external genitalia, but now it's used to refer almost exclusively to the female external genitalia. The word pudendum actually means that of which one should be ashamed.
Really?
So it's really right there in our language. It's such a part of our society and our culture that our sexuality is shameful. It is not to be discussed.
So what do we need to do to change that? Because you've already started doing this by creating your book, which I love.
Yeah, I think that we really need to start questioning these societal messages. I think we need to start questioning why we feel such shame about our bodies. We need to really start talking. We need to start sharing with each other. Something that I'm really hoping will spring from this book is, you know, the ability to talk to each other. And when you read these stories, you realize, like, there's such an incredible diversity of experiences. Of course, there's an incredible diversity in terms of anatomy, but just women's individual experiences are also so diverse. And we're really hoping that, you know, everyone that comes across this book or the website or every woman listening to this radio show tonight will share their own story. And we have a component on our website where women are encouraged to share their story. Mm-hmm. And any woman's story that is chosen as the story of the month and is put on the front page of our website, we'll be sending a free copy of our book to them, because we really see so much value in sharing. You know, so much healing and empowerment and learning can come from sharing, for the individual sharing the story and for everyone that reads the story.
I agree. It's so important not to feel that we're in isolation. And the more we can share in as a community, and that's a great thing in terms of the web as well, and the internet, even though it has brought us pornography as well. But it also opens it up for effort through social media channels as well as blogging. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of forums as well for posting things. It's exciting because we're able to have a voice even if we don't feel comfortable doing it in real life.
Absolutely.
At this stage.
And it's a great medium for women that still, you know, feel this sense of shame to voice their stories out loud. You know, they can still share, and even going through that process of writing their own story, really mm-hmm. coming to terms with how they feel about their sexuality, their genitalia, is a really healing experience mm-hmm. for them. And just the ability to post it anonymously online can just be a first step in that direction.
I think that's really cool. What, out of all the stories, because there's lots of stories in there, are there certain ones that when you heard them or read them where it just kind of hit you and you're like, okay, I'm on the right track, this is what I've meant to do with my life right now?
Yeah, you know, when I first conceived of this idea, and it was really in reaction to these women wanting labiaplasty and this realization that there is no resource tool available for women to really view the diversity of anatomy. But then, you know what, I thought it would be a great idea to have women share their stories. And as these stories started coming in, wow, I was so blown away by what these women were sharing and what they collectively created. I mean, the things that they shared, the things that I've learned, it's really, truly incredible. It's beyond my wildest dreams of, you know, what I could have created. Like, these women really gave of themselves, mm-hmm. you know, body and soul.
And how did it change you as a person?
Oh, it changed me, wow. In surprising ways. It really brought me to an awareness of how society has shaped me. It's made me realize of my own shame. You know, as I've said, although mm-hmm. your listeners might not be aware, I've been a stripper for the past 18 years, half of my life. And wow, I mean, I've just announced that on the radio. You know, that's something that I don't think I could have imagined having said to so many people, you know, even just a year ago. Though if you had asked me that back then, I would have said, oh no, I don't have shame about my occupation. I don't have shame about my body. I don't have shame about my genitalia. But the ability to announce to people that I'm a stripper was really a challenge for me. And I realized in producing this book and knowing that my occupation is so integral to the process, I realized, wow, I'm going to have to share this with people. And I actually shed that shame that I never really recognized I had. And as well, I recognized that I actually had shame using words such as labia and clitoris. which was really shocking to me. You know, a stripper for 18 years, a confident and, you know, intelligent woman, but it runs very, very deep. You know, I think one of the interesting stats is that only 1 in 10 women feel that there is no shame having a conversation about female genitalia. And, you know, that was really shocking to me when I read it until I realized that, wow, you know what? Even if I can talk about these things with friends, there is shame associated with it.
Describe that a little bit more. Give me an example.
Just really in the process of talking about this book and having to use out loud with strangers words such as clitoris and labia, you know, recognizing the feelings that brought up in me. And I think I can illustrate even better with the example of a very good friend of mine who recognized this in herself as well. She has a young daughter and decided it was time to really start talking to her daughter about sex. And she's been, you know, very aware of these kind of issues as I've been speaking to her about this book. So she was really, you know, aware of herself as she was talking to her daughter about sexual anatomy. And she shared with me that she was so aware of the feelings of shame and just that it was wrong to be saying these words to her daughter. And it just felt very strange. But, you know, she recognized that that was not something she wanted to convey. So she tried very hard just to, you know, express herself and share with her photos of the female anatomy and sharing the words with her without any sense of shame. Because, you know, children really learn in so many different ways. And, you know, children can really pick up on shame and things that are left out of conversations. So she did her best to convey all of this with just, like, pride and openness and, you know, just a sense of ordinariness, but she saw within herself that there was a lot of shame associated with it, and it felt strange.
So it's changing a lot of women and their words.
Yeah, I mean, their words. I mean, I can talk a little bit about the words. I think something that is very important and runs fairly deep in our society is the mislabeling of the female genitalia. I think probably the majority of us would call our external genitalia, we would refer to our vulvas as our vagina.
Even Eve Ensler made that very popular worldwide,
Though
I applaud her for V-Day, and she's done some fantastic stuff. And actually, said, I think it says in the foreword of her book that, and she actually recognizes that there. It's a word that people actually knew and actually associated with,
right.
So it just made sense. They actually understood it right away.
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely understand that, because in telling people that I've produced a photo book of women's vulvas, I get some strange looks sometimes, like, what's a vulva? Are you talking about the car? And, you know, but it took me a while to really assimilate it for myself. But I, you know, I first really came across this idea in reading a work by Joni Blank, a beautiful work that's now out of print called Femalia. And in the beginning, there's a little foreword that refers to the use of the word vagina as a psychic mutilation. And I really didn't understand that at first, and I thought, wow, that's really strong, and I don't resonate with that at all. But then, you know, I started just thinking more about this, and for example, reading the stories that women had shared, and I realized, especially, you know, I'll convey this through the telling of a story of one of the women in the book. She was in school and in a sex education class, and by that point she had already been masturbating, and she was masturbating with her clitoris. She was in this sex education class, and the teacher taught her that sex was about the vagina and the penis, and there was no mention of any of the external structures whatsoever. So this sent a very strong message to her as a child that what she was doing was very weird. And it made me realize that, oh, there, you know, language is so powerful. The imagery associated with language, the fact that we don't really refer to our clitoris, our labia, the parts that are often, you know, most important for women's enjoyment of sex. Instead, we refer to our genitals collectively as the vagina, the part of the anatomy that is required for heterosexual sex and reproduction. And most of our language just leaves all of those other good juicy bits out.
Wow. So by getting people talking, how do you think that will change fast, slow, or hard to say in this fast-paced world?
Well, yeah, I think it's a slow process. I think it's a very slow process, especially in this era of, you know, just ubiquitous access to online pornography, and there's still incredibly strong messages about the shame with which we should feel for our sexual anatomy, you know, just the cultural representation of the vulva, the vagina, as unpleasant and malodorous. You know, any commercials that you see about your period, it's always like, oh, we want to hide that away, and we want to make sure that it doesn't smell. And, you know, now the fact that you can take a pill so you get your period only 4 times a year. And, you know, that's just really sending this message to women that our bodies, our natural bodies, the flow of our bodies is not only inconvenient, it's dirty and disgusting. And, you know, we can resort to these medical procedures, you know, taking a pill or getting labiaplasty to correct those things.
It's really scary in terms of that, and definitely in this day and age. Actually, a couple months ago, I was actually speaking to one of my guests in regards to, if you can believe it, in this day and age, hymenoplasty, where it was South Asian community, and he's a counselor who has actually spent a lot of time actually encouraging families not to force their daughters to have it done. But it horrified me, and I thought it was interesting because apparently where it originated was actually L.A., and it was for women doing it for their husbands, for pleasure, for anniversary presents and things like that, which I thought was pretty horrifying, to be really honest.
I mean, that kind of attachment to a very young aesthetic, the, you know, attachment to a woman's virginity, which, again, of course, implies that she's young and
untouched.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the same doctor. Potentially, maybe not. But again, doctors in LA were the ones that really popularized these surgeries. Labiaplasty is just one of them. I mean, there's a whole gamut of female genital cosmetic surgeries, vaginal tightening, G-spot amplification, and a
I
lot
can just
of them,
feel my body just clench right up.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Even repositioning the clitoris to what they suggest is, you know, the more appropriate place to make orgasms easier for women.
But does it really make orgasms easier for women is what I question, because with all that surgery, because I know there were stats, and we haven't done a show on this for a while, but I know before it used to be where some women actually lost sensation because of surgeries and things like that, so they actually did not get as much pleasure.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a risk, and so far there haven't actually been real empirical studies looking at how these surgeries have changed a woman's sexual function. However, you know, many doctors still continue to market these surgeries as, you know, sexual enhancement surgeries.
Wow.
Without real evidence to back it up.
And it's scary if we're buying into it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really preying on women's fears about their bodies. You know, women aren't given the opportunity to recognize that they are normal, that this whole broad, beautiful range of diversity exists, so the doctors capitalize upon that. And, you know, these beautiful women, these beautiful, normal, healthy women, although I also want to make clear, certainly there are women for whom this is a physiological condition, but for many of them, it's just the result of an aesthetic, you know, dissatisfaction with their bodies. And that's where I think these doctors are way off track.
Yeah, and it is sad that we have to resort to surgery in terms of trying to change instead of actually looking inside,
right.
Like literally, and I don't mean down there inside, I mean actually in terms of self-esteem and really actually owning who we are, because I think when you actually came to the studio, I was just in conversation with Val from Folk Oasis and my boyfriend, and just saying that confidence equals sexy to me, and I think like that stat at the beginning that you were saying, just where 89% of women don't view, you know, either or just don't have any feeling whatsoever, or just don't see their genitals as attractive, or, you know, find it not very pleasant. It's interesting where it makes me question if, I wonder if that's one of the reasons, even though I know there's some physiological reasons sometimes, why women have a difficult time orgasming for some women.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a more of a psychological thing.
Absolutely. There have been anecdotal reports. As I said, there's been no empirical research showing an increase in sexual function. However, a number of the doctors who perform labiaplasties have reported anecdotal evidence that women say, oh yes, this has enhanced my sexual pleasure. And I think even that is something to question, because removing a part of your body, you know, this is a psychological problem. You know, when women are very distressed about the appearance of their genitals, and instead of addressing it in a psychological way, removing very sensitive part of tissue of the body. I'm not doing a very good job explaining this, but certainly it makes them feel more confident, and that allows them, you know, greater sexual pleasure. But I just think that the normalization of cosmetic surgery in our society, in a way, disallows for other avenues to come to that level of psychological well-being, instead of just deciding, okay, the solution is labiaplasty. Yeah. You know, we should be focusing on other ways to make women feel confident and comfortable about their bodies. And, you know, one of the women who really sparked this book, one of the women that shared her desire to have labiaplasty, when she looked through this book, she was amazed at the diversity, and I actually witnessed her transformation. She was like, wow, you know, I think I really like my vulva after all. You know, I really think I look good.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of intervention that we need, not this biomedical cutting away at our bodies.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's so key.
Mm-hmm.
I like that story, so I hope she's listening tonight.
Yeah.
So. And I bet you there's a lot of women out there who are, you're getting that reaction from as well.
Mm-hmm.
But especially with somebody you had that conversation with at the beginning of the project before you started, and now where you're at, which I think is lovely.
Yeah, I think it just really allows women to look at how society has impacted us and how, you know, these sociocultural representations don't necessarily reflect the truth of what it is. And, you know, it's starting to accept that this ideal is completely socially created, and this norm that women think they need to meet is, again, socially created, and it's actually not.
Yeah.
It's not representative of women.
At all.
Well, I can't say at all. You know, there are certainly a part
some
of the population
women
that do look like this, but it's one end of the range of diversity.
Mm-hmm. Just that there's more. It's basically, I'd like to think of it almost like as a supermodel, basically, kind of thing, that not everybody has that body type, but that doesn't mean that there's so many not other types of beauty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really, really key to embrace the diversity, as you said.
Absolutely. And we get to, you know, wander around the streets and see different body shapes and sizes, but we very, very infrequently ever get to look at another woman's vulva.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this book is all about.
Which I think is awesome.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a really quick short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk more about this. You've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio on 101.9 FM CITR. We will be right back.
Yes!
Hi, I'm Penny Clark, president of the CITR Student Executive. Between March 7th and 11th, the UBC's Alma Mater Society will be holding a referendum. By voting yes, you will be supporting the continuation of the UPass and a new fee structure to improve AMS student services. This new fee structure includes a $1 increase for CITR and will protect our current funding in the future. With the additional dollar, we will launch a DJ training program, beat matching and spinning, and offer free DJs for your student events. CITR is committed to serving students and staying tuned to student needs. Between March 7th and 11th, vote yes in the AMS referendum.
Yes!
Oh, wow, that was a neat ad. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Sexy in Van City Radio 101.9 FM on CITR. And we have been talking about I'll Show You Mine, and I've got the editor, Renna Robertson, in-house right now. And if you are just joining us, we've been chatting about all sorts of things about vulvas and how amazing they are, and just in terms of embracing as a society, just that there's more than one type. It's not just the ones that we see a lot of times in pornography, and that there's a lot of absolutely beautiful. And her book, if you missed the first half of the show, I'll Show You Mine, has over 60 women in it from 19 to, I believe, 60 years old.
Early 60s.
And so you can get to see different ones and also see their stories, which I love the fact that each woman wrote her own story. And over the break, we were just chatting, and I hadn't had a chance to see these, which I was very excited. And she mentioned that there's two from transgendered women as well, which I thought was really cool. Did you want to speak to that?
Yeah, I just remember getting their emails, and because really word spread just kind of quickly through social media and friends telling friends about the project, and we just got so many women wanting to participate, and we were so lucky to have two trans, I mean, we were lucky to have every single woman, but the fact that two transgendered women volunteered to take part, and both of them really felt so excited and honored to be part of this book, which is just a book celebrating women, a book showing the diversity of women, and certainly these beautiful women fall perfectly, you know, within this book, this range of anatomy, and yeah, both of them share very, very powerful stories.
I think that's really cool. And I applaud you for including all women. I think that's so important. So not just from 19 to early 60s, which I think is really cool, but biological and trans women.
Yeah, we also have the story of one woman who has at numerous points in her life contemplated transitioning into a male form. And, you know, it just shows the incredible diversity of experiences women have with their bodies. So it's really fascinating to read each of these stories and, you know, realize what other women go through.
Was there any story that really jumped out at you?
Oh, there were numerous stories that really jumped out. You know, the one I conveyed about language not being taught about the clitoris, I thought that was very powerful. Yeah, I mean, there's just so many. Of course, the transgendered women, one of them, Emily, shares the entire, you know, story of how her genitals were modified to be created to create the female anatomy. And yeah, some of them are just so celebratory, which is wonderful. Some of them are really challenging to read. A few tell stories of the sexual abuse that they suffered. But I don't even want to pick a single one because they're all so powerful. It's the collective voice of women that makes it so powerful. Just realizing that there's such a diversity of experience. That was really amazing and beautiful to me.
Did you notice a difference between, for example, 19 to 60 in terms of their relationships with their bodies?
What I really found was that the stories of the women who were, you know, maybe in their 40s and 50s and 60s, you know, they really shared the experience of having transitioned from this place of, you know, body doubt and dissatisfaction to coming to this awareness of, you know, just accepting their bodies and loving their bodies. And it's really heartening to see that this is a journey that women can take. We can all learn to love our bodies. And, you know, it's wonderful if we can really start this dialogue and start that process sooner. It'd be amazing to start this dialogue with young people so they never have to even transition from having dissatisfaction and shame about their body to acceptance. Let's just start teaching young people to love and accept their bodies and feel free to talk about their bodies.
So what type of format do you see that happening?
Well, I really think that the book can certainly be a tool for parents to talk to their children. You know, right now, young people all over this country are online looking at pornography. You know, by 18 years old, almost all men, almost three quarters of women have viewed pornography. You know, among 11-year-old boys, the third most commonly Googled term is porn. So kids are looking at porn. Mm-hmm. So I don't think parents should necessarily shy away from this book because it shows naked bodies, it shows female genitalia. I think it's an important tool to give them to say, look, you know, you might be looking at Playboy magazines at your friend's house, you know, or wherever. My sister allows her son to look at Playboy because she thinks it's, you know, it is a sexuality mm-hmm. is just a very natural, healthy human expression. And, you know, but as I said to her, like, he should be looking at a book like this because he's going to grow up thinking that this is what vulvas look like. So I think that, you know, it can really be part of a sexual education program from a very young age.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that'd be lovely. Around the world, I think it would be really neat as well, especially in countries as well where they still do female circumcision.
Mm-hmm.
I think it could be really, really lovely tool, mm-hmm. both for men as well as women.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I really think everyone could benefit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things we touched on in pre-show talk was just I'd asked in regards to whether or not South Asian community, and perhaps the book could be used as a tool again, just to encourage, because I was telling you when I had the girls from the Lace Campaign on in regards to encouraging, which ladies, if you're listening out there, please, please, please get your pap test on your birthday or download the app so it reminds you once a year when to get it, because it's absolutely important to take care of yourself. Watch out for cervical cancer as well, because many of the strands of cervical cancer can actually be treated if they're caught early enough. So it's really important. And guys, when you're listening, please encourage all the women in your life to keep getting tested. It's important. And it was interesting because Lizzie from the Lace Campaign had actually got a couple girls from the SFU campus on from a group called White Orchid, where they were encouraging women in the South Asian community to get pap tests. And I was actually surprised because they told me when I had them on the show that in India, cervical cancer is one of the biggest number one ways that women die. And I was really surprised, and then it made sense, because since then, talking locally in the South Asian community, I found out that it's just something that they don't talk about, quote unquote. And
definitely, women who aren't comfortable speaking about their genitals are going to be very uncomfortable, likely exposing their genitals, even in a medical setting. There was a PhD thesis out just last year, and related articles published since, where they found that women who do have levels of dissatisfaction and insecurity regarding the appearance of their genitals are less likely to seek gynecological care. And that's really scary.
It is.
Because, of course, you know, cervical cancer is something that we really need to be aware of. And a yearly pap can catch that early and make it, you know, not even a very big deal. But you have to have a level of confidence to be in that kind of setting.
Yeah. No, it's true. Have you, in terms of with men, have you found the, like, what has the reaction been in terms of guys to to the book.
Yeah, men have been really positive. You know, I think it's really an incredible tool for men as well to really gain insight into women's experiences. I think it might be kind of scary for some men. A male friend of mine just ordered a copy and said, oh, I'm really scared of this book, because I think that, you know, reading these stories, it's going to give men a deeper understanding, and it's probably harder to treat women in a certain way when you really understand where they're coming mm-hmm. from. And, you know, I think that our social reality can be quite different. You know, if you go through these stories, a very common thread is this sense of shame that women feel. And I don't think that's a common experience for men, to feel shame about their genitals or feel unable to speak with other guys or expose themselves in front of other guys.
I think with men go out of their way to avoid feeling shame. Women go out of their way to avoid feeling fear, mm-hmm. just in general. I had a psychologist on actually speaking about that.
Oh,
in terms of relationships. Mm-hmm. So it's in regards to basically making sure everybody's super happy in relationships, really mm-hmm. making sure not to push either the shame buttons or the fear buttons, mm-hmm. and to basically creating a safety within each other. Mm-hmm. So then that way it can be worked through.
Wow, well, see, then that's very powerful if men can grasp this, you know, have an understanding of the shame, which is so common among women, mm-hmm. then they may be more able to stay away from those hot buttons.
Yeah.
Yeah. And really, I think it's a tool that men, you know, really need. Men also need to see the diversity of anatomy that exists. You know, I'll convey the story of one of these women that has desired labiaplasty, and one of the very damaging experiences for her was being at work and taking her clothes off for this man. When she got to her underwear and removed them, this man said, oh, no, stop, the dance is over. And because she was insecure about that body part, she really questioned him and was like, come on, please share with me, like, what's wrong? What's happening here? Why is it so difficult for you to now look at my naked body? And he said to her, I don't like outy pussies. And that's so incredibly damaging for this woman, but also must have an impact on his sexuality, to not be aware. And of course, everyone's entitled to an opinion, mm-hmm. that's absolutely fine, but if his opinion is based on, you know, pornography and just not having a full understanding of the diversity that exists, that's mm-hmm. very damaging for him as well. So I think it's important that men really look and see what's out there.
No, I think it's important too, and I encourage every man out there to take a look and see. And as I was saying at the top of the show, I think it will give, I know for me personally, when I went flip through the book, and I want to read more in depth, mm-hmm. but with that, just that there's so much diversity and it's so different. And I think it'd be really, really scary in terms of for oral sex, like if I was a man or if I was bisexual or a lesbian, because I wouldn't even know where to begin, like, in all honesty, because there's such differences, and especially if my education was, if I had been mainly educated through pornography, and this is what I think things look like, and when I actually see the different types of vulvas that mm-hmm. different women have and how beautifully unique they are, it might be a little bit freaky, because especially if I'm reading, say, Maxim or mm-hmm. something like that, and it's a how-to article. Mm-hmm. And as you said, a lot of times the diagrams, they don't show everything.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, what do I do? And then it makes someone feel insecure where they feel insecure because they're worried about pleasing their partner.
Yeah, well, I do want to really convey that, you know, though this man has, you know, reacted to this woman that I work with in a, mm-hmm. in a particular way, just study after study has found that men think much more highly of female genitals than do women. You know, 89%, as you said at the top mm-hmm. of the show, 89% of women do not feel that their genitals are sexy, attractive, or beautiful. Men do, you know. Men aren't nearly as concerned about the appearance of our genitals as we are.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's very important to be aware of as well. You know, women are especially uncomfortable during oral sex. That's when their genitals are right there, you know, under scrutiny, but men love female genitalia. You know, certainly there are men that have a preference one way or another, and, you know, there is a fear that young men today viewing, you know, so many images that don't represent inner labia might have a skewed opinion. But really, when it comes down to it, men like vulvas.
They do like vulvas.
and they're not going to get lost. They're going to figure out quickly what's going on down there.
And actually, in hindsight, and this is just a speaking point, but it's an interesting one, just in regards to men and in terms of circumcision versus uncircumcised, where I've got most of my friends that have had children have chosen not to circumcise, whereas I think growing up, because I grew up in the 70s, and a lot of my male friends have, you know, their parents chose to circumcise. And over the years, just different female friends where it was like, oh, you know, I don't like uncircumcised, or I only like circumcised, you know, that kind of thing. In a weird way, it's a strange parallel.
Definitely. I see very strong parallels. In both cases, it's a reaction to
what you know.
You know, exactly, and just sociocultural representations of what normal is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, I remember the first time I saw an uncircumcised penis. And, you know, that's something that is etched in someone's memory when they've only ever seen genitalia looking a certain way. All of a sudden it's like, wow, that's different. And that is very much what is happening with female genitalia. Yeah. And of course now, you know, medical organizations in North America do not recommend circumcision. They recognize that there's no medical value. And, you know, it's really a difficult question for parents to juggle if they're going to actually put their, you know, just very young son through this kind of surgery for what really comes down to preference, aesthetic preference.
It really does come down to preference, except for in Africa, because I do know the World Health Organization had actually done some studies in regards to with HIV, for circumcised. It doesn't seem to, the virus doesn't seem to, can't remember the exact stats. I believe it's a nine time difference, if I remember correctly, between circumcised and uncircumcised in regards to the virus attaching itself.
Yeah, but definitely within our North American society, it's with access not. To
healthcare, you
know, healthcare as well as just good hygiene practices. It's a very different story.
Definitely. Yeah. So, what do you see for future for 20 years from now for women then?
Well, I really hope that women can, even sooner than 20 years, just really begin to start feeling comfortable about their sexuality, feel comfortable about their bodies, recognize, not just women, actually, I hope that all men, because men are victimized by sociocultural representations as well. And I really hope that we can start breaking these down and really questioning why we feel the way that we do about certain body parts and, you know, starting to ask, does this reflect a material truth, or is this an artificially created aesthetic? I really hope that people can begin to feel comfortable expressing themselves.
I hope that happens too.
And just sharing with each other.
Yeah.
I hope that can happen very quickly with this book. I hope that people can start to recognize the power of sharing and, you know, can get on the website and share their story and heal themselves and, you know, or celebrate themselves. I mean, every reaction is different, but it's all important.
It is. So what's next for you?
Well, I'm just really right now dedicated to spreading this message, really, you know, continuing to look at myself in these terms and sharing with other women. And yeah, I'm just really looking forward to connecting with as many people as I can and getting this word out and allowing women to have this book in their hands where they can look and realize that they're well within the range of normal and read these stories and recognize that they're not alone in their feelings.
I think that's really key.
It's been so amazing the whole way through, just connecting with women, connecting with these incredible women who created this book, and, you know, every woman that I get to connect with, you know, every day talking about this topic. It's really incredible. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing, the emails that I'm getting from, you know, even just strangers saying thank you for bringing this topic up and allowing me to talk. And it's really amazing.
So do you want to let our listeners know where they can get the book?
Yeah, the book is available on our website, www.showoffbooks.com. It's available for $40, including shipping to anywhere in North America. The website also has a lot of educational information about this issue. It will also be updated with feature articles written by experts in the field, so you can always check back. We are really encouraging interaction. You know, sure, come to the website and buy a book, but also stay a while, write your own story. You know, share with others, check back and, you know, read another professional expert's take on this whole topic. And then just share the book and share with your friends and your sisters and just talk and question and celebrate.
Mm. Celebrate, I like that. Mm-hmm. And heal.
Yeah.
And I like the fact you've got vulva dialogue going on there.
Yeah.
And people can follow you on Twitter as well.
That's right. Twitter, yes. And Facebook. Twitter, Show Off Books. And Facebook, the same thing. Show Off Books, only spaces in between the words.
Perfect.
Yeah. Lots of great information because I'm really committed to educating people on these topics. So mm-hmm. I've become quite a frequent tweeter. All of this sort of research is really being conveyed, so lots of great information.
No, which is great. And one other thing we should probably celebrate as well, because we are at UBC as well, is that you're a UBC graduate as well, which is fantastic.
Yeah, so. I'm actually a current student as well.
What are you in? So, because you've got your master's.
I do have my master's.
I'm sciences.
A master's of science from UBC, and I'm just continuing on. It's a bit of an addiction of mine, this process of
education.
And yeah,
it's a good addiction to have, constantly evolving.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful place to be, a wonderful environment, and sparks so much.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but really, this book was created in large part right here at UBC. I had an incredible professor, Dr. Jason Winters, a human sexuality prof in the psychology department, who allowed me to stand up in front of his class and talk about this issue and recruit participants. And, you know, a number of students saw posters that I had posted. So this is really, you know, in large part a UBC-based project. It's amazing the reaction I got from this campus. I'm lucky to have been here, because I don't know what the reaction would have been in other parts of the country even. You know, we live in a really great, you know, positive and liberal city where this kind of issue can be talked about, and a book like this could be so quickly made just because of such a, you know, quick positive resonance with so many women.
It's true, and I applaud you for self-publishing as well. And it's gorgeous, so.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you. And up next is Hans von Klaus's Misery Hour. He is a very sexy man to be miserable with. He'll be guiding you through the wee hours with his ambient music and his super hot voice. You've been listening to Sexy in Van City Radio, 101.9 FM on CITR. We will be back next week at the sexy hour of 10 o'clock. Have a good night, everyone. Bye-bye.
The AMS Sexual Assault Support Center offers support services to survivors of sexual assault and other forms of violence, as well as their friends, family members, and partners. They are committed to education and the support of students, staff, faculty, and visitors of all genders. They offer